Welcome to the Aquarimax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 113, recorded May 14th, 2012.
We're so happy to be here.
Greetings.
Yes. Greetings indeed to all of you fish lovers out there.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into our contributors, should we announce to people what we just did this evening?
Oh, yeah. We're going to be guests on the Pet Tech podcast.
That's one of Ken Jones's podcasts, as he was a guest on ours.
Right.
On here on Aquarimax a few weeks ago.
Indeed he was. And he talked about ponds and 10 tips for prospective pond owners. We talked about filtration and gave an overview of filtration. So if you'd like to check that out, you can check that out. I'm not sure exactly when it's going to be released, but as soon as we find out, we'll let you know.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll put it up on Facebook, a link to it or something.
Right.
So.
That was fun.
Today we have quite a few contributors. We may get through it all this week. We may have to take some over to next week. We'll see how it goes.
Yes.
We have Andreka and Nigel in Bridport in the UK, Bob in Boston, Charlie in North Carolina, Carlos in New York, Barbie from Facebook, Mick in Carnforth, and Tony in New York.
Yes. Thank you, everyone, for all of your contributions.
Mm-hmm. First, we're going to hear from Andreka. I remember her poor fishies were feeling a little blocked up, and we were trying to figure out how to fix it.
Especially her grommy.
Yes. And she says, after feeding cooked veggies nearly every day, sweet potatoes, parsnips, and carrots, a frozen pea without the skin, the constipated grammy looks normal without unwanted accessories. For a few days straight, which is the first time in a while, little G, as we call him, has been free and clear.
Cool.
So hooray, it's working. She said she's feeding them frozen mussels, and that's helping their color be really vivid. And they're starting up with Hikari daphnia.
So, a dietary solution seems to have yielded results. That's good to know that our suggestions have borne fruit, so to speak.
It was a very moving suggestion. Okay, sorry, that one was bad. Okay. Now we're going to go to Nigel.
Thank you, Andreka.
Yes, and we're glad your grammy's feeling better. He says, I finally got around to restocking my main tank after deciding to change from a community tank with tetras and corys to an even more lively African cichlid tank with Lake Malawi and Victoria basins. His current stock is Yellow Labs, Met Blue Zebras, Yellowtail, how do you say that?
I think some people say Acei.
Acei? A-C-E-I. Okay.
And some people say Acei. You never know.
Okay. Zebra obliquidens, and some cribs and cherry red haps. Says my fry tanks are housing benga and red Reuben, and firefish are still a little small to join the rest. Do you know any good homemade foods to feed them? As he's would like to feed them something other than just pellets and flake.
Mm-hmm.
So homemade food.
Yeah, well, that can be a good thing because they are all of those. Well, I shouldn't say all, but a lot of the Rift Lake cichlids, the Mbunas specifically, are largely, they eat a lot of vegetable matter, algae, and the little crustaceans and critters that show up in the algae. There are plenty of other fish that eat other things in the lakes, but, and specialize in things like eating fish scales and eyes and so on, so you've got all kinds.
Yeah, somebody's got to do it.
The Mbunas, at least, generally eat aufwuchs, which is the algae with the little critters that live in it, the amphipods and the copepods and so on. Yeah.
How do you say it?
I don't know, but I pronounce it aufwuchs.
Aufwuchs.
Something like that. Anyway, that's their natural food, so some vegetarian fare would be good for them as part of their diet. So one option is to make some gel food with a vegetable base. So you have gelatin, just unflavored gelatin, and you add various pureed vegetables to it. That can be a good option as a supplement for them. So I will put some links.
Any kind of vegetables, anything specific?
Well,
there
that I like specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not really. I've used several things. Anything from some red pepper and some romaine lettuce to You can put parsley and sweet potatoes in it. You can. There are so many different things you can do. Green beans.
So whatever, yeah. Really.
There are a lot of different things. And you know, some people use baby food as the base, so they don't have to puree it separately. Mm-hmm. And you can get some baby food, green beans.
It's not raw, then.
It's not raw.
But I guess if you're pureeing it, that means you probably steamed it. Or you could just use a food processor, couldn't you, and just chop it up really, really fine.
In some cases, so you can do that. It. Yeah, but the gelatin has to be hot, but what you add to it doesn't necessarily have to boil, but the gelatin, the water has to be either boiling or very close to boiling for it to work. But that can be a good one, and I'll put some of those on the show page, some links to some gel food recipes for Nigel. So thanks,
okay.
Nigel.
So that was a good question. Okay, next we are going to hear from Bob in Boston.
New contributor, right?
Indeed. In fact, he just found us about 2 weeks ago and has been having a good time going through all the podcast. And he sent us some very nice comments about us and the show. And we thank you very much, Bob.
How he appreciates our particular slant on things.
Yeah.
So.
And we work together, so it was very nice. He also had some questions. Says, a former tank resident, a female black molly, and now her female progeny, place their lower jaw, upper abdomen areas just above the heater when it's on. They spend about 40% of the day in this position, periodically touching it the way one might touch a hot stove, on and then quickly off every 10 seconds or so. What is this curious behavior? He sent quite a few details of the tank.
Yeah, go ahead and run through those, because I love it when people send details.
Details are great.
So go ahead and run through those.
He says it's a 180-gallon tank. It's about two-thirds full. The heater is 500 watts and rests horizontally across the floor of the tank. The temperature is about 79 degrees. He's breeding German blue rams in it. It's a few degrees colder on the bottom. But this behavior has been present even before he introduced the rams when the temperature was about 70 degrees. Now, remind me, what temperature does Molly's like?
Molly's like pretty warm water. I mean, you can be in the 80s and they're still happy. So,
okay.
They're fairly adaptable fish, but they kind of like warmer water.
Okay. So the tank is mostly rainwater.
It's got...
Sorry, sometimes I don't know all the abbreviations, what they mean. Oh,
he's got 2GH, that stands for general hardness.
Oh, okay.
And 5.8 pH, and pH.
I think I'd know that by now. But again, this behavior existed when the water came from the tap, and it was in the normal 5 general hardness and 7 pH range, 7.0 pH range.
Now, I just want to interject here and say that both of those values are pretty low for the comfort range of mollies.
So just they like it point more that than that?
Right.
Okay.
Typically, they like a more alkaline water and fairly on the hard side, so there you go.
Okay. It was also on display during a brief period when he added salt. Ammonia nitrates register near zero. There's no filters or air stones. It changes about 30% of the water every day. Does it rain a lot in Boston? It's rainwater.
It rains more than it does
30%
here.
30% of the water every day.
Rains more than it does here.
How does he collect the rainwater? Does he just have like a bucket outside that he catches it in?
I don't know. He may have a catchment system. I don't know. That's what Mick uses for
that's
his fish room. He has a cistern and a catchment system.
That's cool.
It's a good way to do it if you can.
Wouldn't work here.
Now, one thing he mentions is the ammonia nitrates register near zero. Now, it's good for nitrates to be pretty low, but ammonia needs to be at zero for the fish to be happy. So I'm just wondering if he means if both of those values are near zero, then that could be a problem. So just bringing that up, but go ahead.
You mean near zero as opposed to at zero.
Right. We need ammonia to be at zero, not even measurable.
But
nitrates don't have to be that low, but there you go.
Okay. Says but there's no growth.
Since he's doing 30% water changes, and the water
seems
is
like
rainwater, 30% water change is certainly going to help. Another thing is that if it's rainwater and it has fairly low pH, I mean, at that pH, all the ammonia is going to be... pretty close to all the ammonia is going to be ammonium, which is not very toxic to fish, so that's a good thing.
Okay. There's no gravel, but lots of floating plants and lots of plants in clay pots filled with organic garden soil. I do not use plant fertilizer.
Okay, if he has lots of plants, maybe he's ammonia and he doesn't even have to worry because if it's showing up, then that still could be a problem, maybe, but the plants are going to be taking care of a lot of it.
Okay. Total fish population is 18, mostly small fish. 6 1-inch clown killies, 3 pairs of 1-inch black mollies, and a pair each of guppies, betas, and rams. So for a 180-gallon tank, it doesn't sound like he's got a high bio load at all.
Right, that's a very low bio load, so his values are probably pretty good. Mm-hmm. I just keep on adjusting what I'm saying. It's, I get more information.
That's but okay.
I
guess that's okay. That's why we like details, yeah?
I have read it through before, but it's been a while, so...
The fish are fed lots of protein, such as black worms, brine shrimp, insect larvae, and some flakes. The mollies also feed on algae cultivated on the aquarium side. Small creatures that live in the algae, unlucky baby fry and cherry shrimp, and surface scum, which appears when I occasionally add water from my man-made pond.
See, this is interesting, because that sounds like a pretty good diet for mollies. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that it's such a good diet if they weren't feeding on the algae, because they do need a lot of vegetable matter on the diet. But if they're getting plenty of algae, then that sounds like a pretty good diet for mollies.
Okay. He says there's a few more details. About 4 months ago, he had an outbreak of gill flukes. He got it from his local fish store. But he added Prazipro, and there's been no flashing since then. He says he introduced some small leeches on purpose when he witnesses Beta actually eat one. They came kind of mixed in with black worms. 2 weeks ago, he went into his tank room when it was dark, the flashlight to harvest the baby betas, mollies, and guppies, and he saw a leech about. He says, "I saw a leech about the size of Godzilla." Couldn't catch the monster, and assume he still lurks. But again, the fish show no discomfort and breed freely. He says, "I did make a vow that night to trap the sucker with raw liver."
It's probably a good idea.
Yeah. That was kind of scary. One of the male mollies exhibits the heater behavior, but otherwise, this is an exclusively female behavior. All the mollies are drawn to the sunlight when it hits the tank in the afternoon.
Wow. I'm really glad for all that information. It's painting me a pretty interesting picture of the situation. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you a few things. Now, one thing you mentioned is that the mollies put their lip and the underside of their belly kind of up against the heater. That's something that's puzzling me quite a bit. And I must admit, this whole business is something of a mystery to me. But mollies nibbling heaters in some form or another is a very common phenomenon, apparently. At least it's common enough that it shows up a lot. So what
Why?
I have done...
Why do they do that?
We'll see. We have to get to that. We'll get
I'm,
to that.
I'm jumping ahead.
No, that's okay. That's okay. It's a perfectly good question. The thing is, I did some research on this one because I was so confused. So, Bob, you came up with a really good question here.
You gotta think, are they just neurotic?
I began to do some searches on this topic, and I found a lot of people had comments about mollies doing weird things with heaters.
Weird.
Mollies, they would use the words kissing heater, they would use singed mollies, they would say all kinds of different things, but apparently mollies like to react to heaters in very bizarre ways. Now,
so they've just got this little kind of...
heater fixation?
Masochistic, burn myself on the heater.
Well, some of them apparently do that, and this doesn't really sound like what's happening to Bob's mollies, per se, but a lot of them seem to have some sort of fixation with heaters.
Heater.
Some of them pick at it incessantly with their mouths. And, of course, mollies are grazers, very much grazers. They're always picking at things. They pick at algae and biofilm in the aquarium, and that's pretty normal, and they do that a lot more than a lot of other fish. There are other fish that do that, but your typical community aquarium fish doesn't do it as much as mollies do. They just they do it a lot. So this is really interesting to me. And maybe exactly what they're doing, maybe a video might shed some light on it, exactly what happens when they go to the heater. Of course, they do like warm temperatures, and sometimes they may just be basking, so to speak.
They just want to be warmer.
They want to be warmer, and so they're getting... Now, and that makes sense, a lot of sense.
Well, I could see that, though, because, you know, you're basking, you get sleepy, and then all of a sudden you hit the heater and jerk back.
Maybe so.
I don't know that it would work that way for a fish.
Maybe not. I don't know. But the 70 degrees, I mean, I could totally see why they would hang around the heater and try to get warm, you know. But less
but
so when
it's
79 degrees, which is pretty warm. They might like it just a little touch warmer, maybe. But it seems like 70... I've kept mollies at temperatures like that when they were perfectly fine and they didn't hang around the heater, so... I don't know what's going on there. But it is interesting that there are a lot of heater-worshipping mollies out there. So maybe we've discovered some kind of phenomenon. Some people posit that maybe they're they're going for salt on the heater in saltwater tanks, and you can keep mollies in saltwater tanks, and at least one of these was talking about that or seemed to be talking about that.
He's just got fresh water, though, yeah?
This is fresh water now, yeah. Yes. Other people talk about how mollies like to... that heaters attract certain biofilm, certain types of algae and bacteria that grow on them. Maybe different from other places in the tank, and the mollies are attracted to that.
So they just think, ooh, this is heater delicacy.
Right, maybe what's growing on there is either... it either tastes different than things that grow in other places, mm-hmm. or it has different nutrients.
Interesting.
So they're seeking it out. Who knows if maybe there are certain types of archaeans, extremophile bacteria-like creatures that may live on heaters in aquariums that... don't occur in other places in the aquarium because they need that heat. You never know. I mean, there are plenty of thermophilic archaeans in the world that live in extreme environments that are very warm and are only found in those areas. I'm just throwing that out. You know, I don't know, but it would be interesting to find out more about that. Maybe do some cultures of heaters like that and see what you find.
Are they hurting themselves when they touch the heater? He says they jerk back, you know, like they touch a hot stove. So do they look injured? Are they missing scales? Does it look burned?
Now, in his case, it doesn't sound like it. It sounds like they're breeding and they're healthy.
Okay.
I'm a bit baffled.
I think
baffled.
A video would be good.
Yeah. But I'm going to send Bob, I'm going to put on the show page, I've got 6 or 8 links of posts that are related to these molly phenomena, and hopefully they can shed some light on the situation that... they helped me formulate, you know, my idea of some of the things that I spoke about, and maybe they will help you too. But this is a really weird one. I'm really glad you brought it up. It's fun to encounter such a bizarre situation.
Yeah.
And wonder about it.
And if he does get a video of it, can he just post that on the Facebook page?
Yeah, he should be able to do that.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Or he can send us the YouTube link.
Oh, that would work too. Okay. And I think we are going to take our break now.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629. Or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nelly.
Welcome back. We are moving ahead. We're going to talk about Carlos's comments from the Facebook page this week.
Yeah, he was wondering, with his spawn of Bristlenose plecos, he has recently spawned for the first time. He was wondering if, when I suggested that he use green beans as a food, canned green beans specifically as a food, he was wondering if he had to rinse them first, and I mentioned that I don't rinse them, and they seem to be doing fine.
You basically just pack them in water, don't they?
Yeah, and there are some other things.
You don't pour the juice in,
right.
If it were.
And there's some salt in the water and some other things, but it doesn't seem to hurt them at all.
Okay.
And, yeah, but you don't pour the juice in the tank, that's right. And you know, I always split them first. It's important to split them down a little.
Did we tell them the story of Gwen?
You go ahead and tell them that story.
This was very cute. When was this?
A year or two ago.
2 years ago. She was little. Mm-hmm. She's only 6 now, so she couldn't have been more than 4. She might even have been 3.
Right. It might have been 3 years ago.
Yeah. She was pretty little, because I was surprised. And she wanted to feed the fish. Russ wasn't home. She wanted to feed the fish some green beans. So I got them out.
And they were baby bristlenoses.
They were, yeah. And, you know, I was about to... put them in the tank, and she says, no, wait, Mama, you have to split them open. And she's saying all this in baby talk, but you have to split them open or they can't eat them. I'm like, oh, my little 3-year-old is teaching me how to feed the fish.
And that's especially true with frozen ones. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we were using at the time. I don't remember.
I don't remember.
But
I just thought it was so funny. She's so little, and she's remembering these details about the correct way to feed the green beans to the fish.
Because they do respond to them better if they're split.
Yeah. That was cool. Cute.
It was. And Carlos mentions that his are doing quite well. They're sharing a half-full 10-gallon tank with 10 angelfish fry that are also growing quickly.
Oh, nice.
And the plecos seem to enjoy the frozen baby brine shrimp and algae wafers for now, and that's, you know, that's a pretty good diet for them. And then he posted again after that he had tried the beans, and he said they love them. They leave them looking like little canoes. So they really do empty
yeah,
it out.
They do.
And he's doing a 25% water change every day, because they are messy little monsters, he mentions. Mm-hmm. It's true. And they're growing pretty quickly. So
that's exciting.
Yeah. And then Barbie F on Facebook also responded to him and said, they will start to eat before the yolk is absorbed, because he asked me about that, and I had never had direct experience with that, because mm-hmm. I had always started feeding them afterwards. But she said they will start to eat before the yolk is absorbed, given the chance, and the male will be fine even though he had to separate them, because mm-hmm. she's done that before. She said she's moved a spawn to a new cave in a pinch, and it seems to be fine. And she said with that many in a 10-gallon... to increase the water changes, because they will eat, I like this phrase that she used, they will eat, phraseology, they will eat almost exactly twice what you think could be possible. And they are incredible eaters, and they're extremely messy. So I'm sure that's why Carlos is doing a 25% water change, but it wouldn't hurt to do it even more if you could. I mean, I know you have to worry about practicality with that sort of thing, but...
Well, come on, we don't need to eat and shower, right? Okay, so thank you, Carlos, and good luck with your babies. We are going to hear from Mick now. It says he had to do an emergency pond repair a couple of weeks ago. One of his liners had a slight leak, and when he got back from work, almost all the water had gone, and the frog spawn had dried out.
That's sad.
That is so sad.
Poor frog spawn.
Yeah, poor pond. Poor Mick.
Yeah.
So he says, next morning... it was all hands to action stations, and as we have both frogs and our common smooth newts in there, it took us about 3 hours to sift through all the remaining water to net out the survivors, which amounted to 70 juvenile newts, 20 large frogs, and 15 small frogs from the previous season, all in a pond 4 feet square and 20 inches deep.
Wow.
That is a big wow.
Yeah. That's a high amphibian density.
Yeah. Now that's a pretty fancy phrase you just said there. So they put the newts in a big rubber type tub with water, climb outs, a loose lid, and an air stone while they relined the pond. We have now added a trellis top to keep our 18-month-old daughter out. Good idea. And started replanting up with Bacopa oxygenating weeds and watercress to help filter the waters. The pump just runs the water through a fish spitter, which is more decoration. I've been supplementing the pond with my worm cultures, as although we had enough stored rainwater to refill the pond, we will have removed most of the natural microorganisms in the food chain.
Good idea.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to get some bags of live Daphnia from the local fish store to try to kickstart things now. There's some algae returning for them to feed on.
Yeah, then it's good to wait until you've got some of that going.
But they sent us some pictures, too.
Yeah, we're going to put those on the show page.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry for your... pond explosion.
But we're glad that you took such quick and effective action. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we'll look forward to posting those pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And best wishes to the reestablishment of the pond.
Yes,
I think it's really
poor
cool.
Poor homeless newts and froggies.
I think it's really cool that Mick has this pond with native species in it going.
Yeah, that's so cool. I'm trying to remember when he first started telling us about the pond. He didn't put them in, did he? They just.
I think I remember him. He said that the smooth newts, he found them breeding in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We have some pictures of the little newt larvae that he pulled out and stuff. So
that's pretty cool. Okay. Tony.
Tony
from
in
New York.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Asking about sea monkeys.
Sea monkeys. Now, he's talking about the actual proprietary brand name.
Like he went and bought a sea monkey kit from the store.
Okay, well, he's talking about those, the ones you actually buy, because sometimes you'll hear people refer to brine shrimp as sea monkeys, but he's referring to the actual brand, the trademarked hybrids that are sold as sea monkeys.
Okay.
And so he was wondering about their keeping.
He wanted to know if it's identical to that for regular brine shrimp, or if it's really specialized. The manufacturer says, for example, will a certain salt solution do the trick for them, or does one indeed need to buy a large stock of living plasma packets for them to work in a large tank?
So, Tony, yes, we have kept sea monkeys before. In fact, We probably have, I don't know, 4 years of Sea Monkey experience, something like that. Not necessarily continuous, but as Kelly was saying,
I think they were our first real pets after we got married.
Yeah, I believe they were. And I had kept them before that, and we've kept them subsequent to that as well. So their care is pretty similar to regular brine shrimp, but I don't actually recall if we ever tried keeping them outside of the suggestions made by the marketers of sea monkeys.
At the time, that first time when we were just married,
mm-hmm.
we were in a very small apartment. We didn't have any tanks, really.
We didn't until later.
Keeping them in, so we just kept them in what they came in at the time.
Right, but we've done some experiments with mm-hmm. various types of brine shrimp since.
Have you rehatched them from eggs that you dried out from there?
I have done that, yeah.
And I'm sure we put them in different containers then, didn't we?
Well, no, I think we used original containers, actually.
Oh.
Following
so
the directions.
We just do that because it's got the magnifying glasses on it?
I don't remember what our rationale was, but we did that and it worked out. They did hatch, and we had we kept other shrimp and fed them food that was marketed for sea monkeys, and that worked well.
That worked fine.
But
yeah.
I don't think we did the opposite. I don't think we ever fed the sea monkeys anything other than the food that was marketed for them.
Do the manufacturers say that it's a different strain?
Actually,
or do
they
just say buy our own stuff?
As I understand it, they have legal rights to the particular ones they sell because they are a hybrid.
Oh, what are they hybrided of?
I'm not sure which species are the parent species of this hybrid, but
that's interesting.
That's how they have a claim on them as their own.
It's a copyrighted kind of patented critter.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a trademark or a patent or copyright or what it is, but they have those legal rights to them because they are a hybrid. And so I'm not sure about the salt solution and so on. I do know that we've experimented with moving other brine shrimp, like the Great Salt Lake and the San Francisco strain, into different water of amazingly variable salinities, like when we put them in the Opaula tank.
Mm-hmm.
And he does mention that. He was wondering how that was going now, an update on that. So I wish I could answer the question about the living plasma packets, or you can do it another way. You could keep normal brine shrimp, you know, San Francisco or Utah type, in a larger tank without any problems. One thing I would suggest, though, make sure the tank's cycled. I learned that through experience, mm-hmm. that if you want to keep brine shrimp successfully and healthily, cycling helps and surface area helps. I've used Tahitian moon sand to provide some surface area, fairly, not a large amount of it, but enough to increase the surface area. It really makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
They do a lot better once the tank is cycled.
Cycling is always good for cycling. It's good for what ails you.
Right? Yeah. And one thing that you'll find on the internet, most people who talk about culturing, there's hatching brine shrimp, there's large-scale culture of brine shrimp as a food source, and then it's a whole different ballgame from just keeping a small amount of brine shrimp for interest, for pets' mm-hmm. sake. Very, very different rules and so on. You don't need to use aeration, for example, necessarily. It does increase the number of brine shrimp you can keep in a small area, even if you do partial aeration, meaning not constant, but you just aerate it several times a day. That makes a big difference in my experience. Some interesting things like that. So to answer your question about the update on our Opaula and brine shrimp tank, this is what happened. Okay, we put some brine shrimp in just to see what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
They throve. They did very well. They began to reproduce. And maybe not all of our listeners know that brine shrimp can reproduce in two ways. One, they can produce the cysts or resting eggs that can then, you know, be subjected to all sorts of extremes and hatch later. They can also just produce young that are essentially live, or either they're live or they hatch very shortly after being produced. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, they don't have any sort of resting period.
They don't wait.
Right. They began to reproduce in the latter fashion, producing live young, or what amounted to live young, and swimming around, and they went through several successful generations doing so. I think what eventually happened is that they reduced the particulate type food in the water column that they needed and began to decline. And in an effort
did
to keep the...
Did they not eat the same thing that the opiulate needs?
They can eat suspended spirulina, but they need kind of a higher concentration because they don't pick it up in the same way.
Oh, okay.
So I was afraid to add too much food to the tank because I didn't want the opiulate to suffer.
Right.
And so what happened is the brine shrimp ended up suffering, which was unfortunate. But apparently they can coexist indefinitely, and they would have continued to exist had I increased the amount of food available to them, but I was hesitant to do so just to make sure the water quality
could... So depending on how your tank is set up water quality-wise.
Right. But otherwise, I think they would have kept going with the opiula. So, but they did do, as I mentioned, several generations. I'm not sure exactly how many. I should have documented more closely, but I think it was maybe 4 or 5 generations. I did fine.
Here's a potential science experiment. If any of you have kids who have to do the science fairs, do the sea monkeys with their instructions and then do the sea monkeys with normal brine shrimp conditions and see if there's any difference. So thank you, Tony, for your question about the sea monkeys. And it looks like we are actually just about out of time for this week. So he has some more questions, but I think we will get to those next week.
Yeah, and thank you to all of our contributors.
Mm-hmm.
And may the fish
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.